Hi everybody, Liam here. Before we start today's episode, a few messages from my sponsors. In 1972, an artist named Romare Bearden created a mural for the chamber of Berkeley City Council. He called the work Berkeley, the City and Its People. It's a remarkable homage to the civic spirit of Berkeley. The mural shows Berkeley's past, present, and future in layers of collage, fashioned from photographs, paint, and colored paper. Look closely, and you'll see a familiar icon, four faces in profile. Those faces represent Berkeley's diversity, and now they're Berkeley's official city logo. However, Bearden's mural, it's no longer on view at City Hall, but you can see his nearly identical original study at BAM PFA, the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive located in downtown Berkeley. The work is part of a show called What Has Been and What Could Be. It also features 17th century Japanese scrolls, American landscape paintings, African American quilts, and feminist art. This exhibition is on view through July 7th, and gallery admission is free on the first Thursday of every month. Find out more at bampfa.org. Next, a message from UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals. According to the California Department of Public Health, Black babies in the Bay Area are 2 to 3 times more likely to be born too soon or too small or even die before their first birthday compared to white babies. Scientific evidence points to structural racism and a systemic lack of cultural awareness by providers among the causes of these disparities. To address this inequity in health outcomes, doctors and nurses at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital Oakland created Bloom, the Black Baby Equity Clinic. This new clinic at UCSF Children's matches mothers and families with culturally responsive pediatric care and provides help like lactation counseling, checkups, and critical support. UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals are committed to providing equitable care that makes a difference. To learn more about the Bloom Clinic, check out the show notes or read more on East Bay Yesterday's social channels. Okay, on with the show. You're listening to East Bay Yesterday. This show is about history, but it's not stuck in the past.
Let's begin.
Berkeley is a pretty small city. It only has about 124,000 residents, according to the last census. Another city on the other side of Alameda County is Fremont, which has 100,000 more people than Berkeley, but far less name recognition. And I'm not trying to pick on Fremont here, just trying to make the point that for a fairly small place, Berkeley has a very prominent reputation. People from all over the country, all over the world even, know Berkeley, and many of them have strong opinions on it as well. Some of the reasons for this fame or notoriety, some might say, are fairly obvious. The University of California's flagship school has been here since the 1860s. And of course, Berkeley became synonymous with leftist politics during the 1960s with the rise of the free speech movement and other student-led activism. Berkeley's maintained this status as a symbol of progressivism, even radicalism, ever since then, which I know this reputation doesn't always line up with reality, but still, I mean, like the AP recently described Berkeley as, quote, an eccentric California city renowned for tie-dyed hippies and highbrow intellectuals. So, like it or not, that's the popular image of this place. Anyway, I have a slightly more nuanced take on why Berkeley is so well known, and it sort of builds off these other more obvious reasons. The reason why Berkeley is so famous, despite being a relatively small city, is because of how influential this place is. So many political and cultural trends that end up going national, even global, either started here or were adopted very early on here. People pay attention to Berkeley because when Berkeley does something new, everyone else knows they could be getting a preview of the future. Lots of Berkeley's innovations have been positive: health benefits for domestic partners, curb cuts to make sidewalks more accessible for disabled folks, banning styrofoam. Berkeley became the first place to pass a sanctuary city resolution, and in 1992, it became the first city in the U.S. to officially dump Christopher Columbus in favor of Indigenous Peoples Day. Plus, I don't think anyone will be surprised to hear that Berkeley was way ahead of the curve when it came to decriminalizing marijuana. Berkeley voters passed a law that reduced enforcement of weed laws back in 1973. Oh, and we can't forget that Ohlone Park has what's been called, quote, the world's first official dog park. This collection of Berkeley's trailblazing ways isn't even getting into food culture or the countless innovations that have come out of the university, because that list would basically take up the entire rest of the episode. I've been doing this show, East Bay Yesterday, for about 7 years now, and I've picked up a lot of stories about Berkeley's history of innovation and influence along the way. But the thing that's really astonishing is these stories, they just keep coming. All the time, I'm learning new things about how the people of Berkeley have changed the world. And the latest example of this comes from local reporter Ali Markovich. On the Berkeley Side website, Ali recently published a two-part series on the history of Indian rock and mortar rock, which are two adjacent outcroppings poking out of the Berkeley Hills. And apparently, they've both been significant local landmarks for a very, very long time. The first article in her series is focused on the indigenous history of these rocks and gets into their importance to the Ohlone people. You can still see the bowl-like depressions where Ohlone used stones to grind seeds for millennia. The view from these rocks looks directly out to the Golden Gate, so we know that this has been a popular and sacred gathering place for probably about as long as people have existed here. The second article in her series is the one that we're focusing on today, and it's about more recent history, roughly the last century or so. The piece is called How Berkeley's Famous Boulders Took Rock Climbing to New Heights. In it, Ali explains how so many titans of American rock climbing experimented with new techniques here and pioneered ideas that would go on to change the sport forever. The funny thing is, you could walk by these rocks 100 times and not know any of this. To most people, they probably just look like, well, big rocks surrounded by trees and houses. But to climbers, these rocks are much more. They're a mecca. They're an endless challenge. They're a place where every nook and cranny holds memories. So, on today's episode, I'll be talking with Berkeley Side reporter Ali Markovich about the history of Indian and mortar rocks. We'll be talking about how the community of people who climb here has had a massive influence on the evolution of climbing and bouldering. And we'll also discuss something I've been kind of curious about, which is how and why climbing has exploded in popularity so much over the last decade or so, because as you've probably noticed, there are a lot of climbing gyms around the Bay these days. This is East Bay Yesterday. I'm Liam O'Donohue. Stay tuned.
Yeah, so maybe I'll like start just describing the rocks a little bit.
That'd be great.
Yeah, so right now we're sitting at the top of Mortar Rock, and if we look back, there's a two-story house that we're just about level with the second story, so it's really not all that high, and actually a lot of the action happens, you know, underneath one story. Also, funnily enough, that little rock right there, if you see that's called Little Yosemite. So, it's partially because they I don't really see it, but...
It's quite an aspirational name. I mean, there's a part of Sunol out in the East Bay Regional Park District that people call Little Yosemite as well. And I'm like, that's kind of reaching.
A little bit. Yeah, maybe a lot. Yeah, people think that it looks like... I want to say Half Dome, but... Or no, El Cap?
Yeah.
I have to look. But the people say there's a resemblance to one of the cliffs. And yeah, that's why. But yeah... Anyway, so the...
And yeah, we're surrounded by oak trees and some conifers as well, and they're taller than these rocks. So for people at home who've never been here, these are not like giant towering cliffs. This is, you know, rocky, kind of bouldery outcroppings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the rock itself is called rhyolite, which is a rock that is, say, like cousin to granite. It's really hard, like granite, and so it makes it really good for rock climbing, but it's more like twisty and glassy than granite is. Granite tends to almost look like it's like made up of a ton of tiny stones, and this has a different, I don't know quite how to describe it, but...
Maybe a little smoother to the touch.
Yeah, yeah, and a little bit easier on the hands. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And it formed from magma cooling really quickly, 10 million years ago. And the reason that these rocks sort of all got broken up and moved around the way that they were is that all these earthquakes, because we're along the Hayward Fault, broke up the rocks and shuffled them around and moved them around. And so that's why this, all of this is, you know, kind of cut up by roads. So it's hard to tell, but it's all a bunch of rocks right near one another. All really low to the ground and all quite excellent for bouldering.
Ooh, let's just pause there for a quick second. I think a lot of people probably know what bouldering is, but there's probably still some people who are unfamiliar with that term. So what's the difference between climbing or rock climbing and bouldering?
Yeah, so bouldering is a kind of low to the ground rock type of rock climbing where you use nothing but your hands and feet, whereas with other forms of climbing, there's often ropes involved, or it's much higher. So I think, I'd have to look it up, but I think it's like 20 feet, 30 feet, something like that. It's a, kind of a height limit for bouldering.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. So you were talking about sort of what made this place such a mecca. Why was it so influential?
Yeah. So I think the thing with a place like Yosemite is that it's the kind of place that people will go to from all over the world. I think with a place like Indian and Mortar Rocks, it's the kind of place where it's right in your backyard. And so people who are training to go to one of those destinations like Yosemite need to practice somewhere. You're not going to go to Yosemite every single weekend. And where are you going to learn the skills in order to be able to climb safely and successfully in such an ambitious place? And because of the high concentration of rock climbers here in the Bay Area and in Berkeley especially, this kind of became a hub. So maybe we'll wait.
Okay, so as you might have just noticed, the sound of a leaf blower kicked up in the background there, so we had to move this interview. We started out at Mortar Rock, but after the dreaded leaf blower intruded upon our tranquility, Allie and I moved down to Indian Rock. At this point, I should mention that Allie is a climber herself. She got interested in these rocks by spending a lot of time here during the pandemic when the climbing gyms were closed. And when we met up, Allie loaned me her copy of Golden State Bouldering, a California climbing Bible. Here's what that book has to say about this very scenic spot. Quote, Indian Rock is the granddaddy of climbing in the Bay Area. It was popular with climbing superstars of the 60s and 70s. But Indian Rock isn't just for climbers. It's also frequented by families scrambling on the rocks, young lovers on a date, and anyone in need of a moment to smoke a doobie while the sun sets over the bay. Right on, man. All right, back to the interview. I'm here with Allie Markovich. We have relocated to get away from the dreaded leaf blower man, one of the great arch nemeses of quiet residentially Berkeley Hills. And we are going to jump back into this interview. So before we moved, you were telling me about You know, the history of Indian and mortar rocks and about how these have played a really crucial role in the history of American climbing. So let's jump into that. Can you tell me a little bit about like the evolution of climbing over the last century or so and the role that Indian and mortar rocks here in the Berkeley Hills have played in that trajectory?
Yeah, I think the fascinating thing about Indian and mortar rocks and honestly various places around the bay in general is that they have this, they're tiny but have this outsized influence in the in this case in the history of the sport. So in the 30s the climbers who went here effectively developed the techniques that made some of the big ascents that we now know about in Yosemite possible. And later on in the 70s and 80s, when the sport transitioned from that kind of technical, kind of big wall style climbing to bouldering, form of low to the ground rock climbing, where you just use your hands and feet, Indian and mortar rocks was one of those places that was central to this transition. So a lot of big names from Dick Leonard or David Brower, people who went on to lead the Sierra Club, are these sort of fathers of rock climbing and the environmental movement in some ways. Two people like Alex Honnold, who climbed here and he was a student at Cal.
People might remember him from the movie Free Solo, right? I think that did that win an Oscar, like best documentary? I think so, a couple years ago. Either way, it got a lot of attention, made a lot of people very nervous. I'll say that much.
A lot of hand sweat caused by that movie.
yeah, definitely. So these famous climbers would come here and sort of pioneer these different techniques. What did that do for the local climbing culture? Tell me about like how that's evolved over the generations.
That's an interesting question. Okay, like a couple of things come to mind. One is like the culture of this particular place. So one of the things I learned about, you know, while I learned a lot about the development of the sport of rock climbing via studying Indian and mortar rocks for the story, I also learned a lot about like the vibes of the place, which struck me as equally, if not more, important.
Let's get into the vibes. Tell me about the vibes.
Yeah, so I think this is one of those kind of special third places for a lot of people. It's many people's second home. Climbing is for many people their second family or their chosen family. And people would, you know, spend their entire childhoods or young adulthoods here, building, you know, while working on these problems together with their friends and trying to ascend the walls, would build deep connections with each other and with the place. And many of the people who climbed here, you know, climbing became the thing in their lives, and this place was their introduction to it. And I think for many people who are deeply involved in the climbing community around the bay today, I think that feeling really rings true. You know, I remember one of the stories I heard was, so there's one climber who goes by Verm, short for Vermin, John Sherman, really famous boulderer. And he told me that when he came here as a kid, you know, his coming of age was like very much centered here. And he met a guy named Dave Altman, who was known as kind of the mayor of Indian Rock, quote unquote. And he was like total dirtbag, lived in his van, didn't have much and didn't need much. And that inspired Verm to kind of emulate his life of like, oh, I don't need all these things and these possessions. What I need is my climbing. You know, I need, you know, in Dave Altman's case, it was books, it was math textbooks. So it introduced him to a totally new way of life that he hadn't known about. And like that kind of dirtbag culture is, yeah, still very strong.
I think people who aren't even climbers are familiar with this sort of archetype now of the person who gets obsessed with climbing, sort of leaves their life behind. I think you profile some of these people who like kind of abandon their academic careers or other, you know, potential pathways in life to focus really on climbing. And it's not just something they do when they're young. It's something they do until they literally can't do it anymore. So, I mean, yeah, what is it about this sport that just makes people so obsessed? Whether, I mean, there's people who are really into golf, for example, but they're not like, most of them aren't abandoning their families and careers to, you know, travel around the country, like sleeping in the parking lot of golf courses. What is it about climbing that like will make people literally like live in a van just so they can climb all day?
Yeah, one of the people I talked to, a climber named Scott Fry, who grew up in Kensington and Berkeley area and climbed here for several decades. You know, at one point, I got tacos and margaritas with him and this other climber, Nat Smale, who's responsible for the famous Nat's Traverse in Mortar Rock. And on the way down, he's biking home, and he, you know, I sort of asked him the same question, and he's like, you know, it was all I had. And I think for many people who devote their lives to climbing and to a place like Indian and Mortar Rock, it becomes everything for them. Some of those people don't have much to begin with, and it becomes a metaphor for meaning in their lives and for community if they don't have one. And I think... Yeah. I think it's like, this doesn't answer your question, but I think it's kind of interesting that like there is like this dirtbag culture, but there's also very much this like PhD grad student culture too. Because even if you think about the first people who were climbing here, they were all grad students at Cal, like lawyers in training and all these people. So there's kind of, and so many people are like math PhD nerds who are climbers too. So I'm not sure.
Maybe after spending, you know, all day staring at inscrutable problems in some textbook, you've got to grab something a little bit more tangible in order to make sense of the world. I don't know.
No, I feel like it's the opposite. You just then grab some more inscrutable problems on the rock.
Well, speaking of students and the fact that like a lot of the, especially like, you know, previous generations of climbers, like in the 60s and 70s, a lot of these people involved in this community were going to school at Cal. They weren't just climbing on the rocks up here. Something else you allude to in the article, but don't go into too much detail about, is bouldering. Mm. So tell me, what is bouldering, and are there any stories that you didn't publish that you can share with the listeners of East Bay yesterday during this conversation?
Bouldering is essentially bouldering on buildings, and it was really popular among the crew of students and young people who were climbing here in the 70s and 80s. I think it just, my sense is that it scratched that naughty itch, I guess, that some rock climbers have. And there's some amazing shots of like some of those climbers ascending like the optometry building at Cal or these sorts of things. Like they look very surrealistic. I will show you.
So these guys are just walking around campus, and every building looks to them like something potentially climbable, right? Or at least a lot of the buildings, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. You just, yeah. You start looking at everything with a new lens, which is, can I get up this?
Yeah. No, I get that. I was a skateboarder when I was a teenager, and I was like, every time I'd be at a staircase, I'd be like, could I jump off this staircase on my skateboard? Now I don't think like that anymore because I don't want to break my bones now that I'm in my 40s. But yeah, I can kind of understand like how, whatever your sort of interest is, you sort of see the world through that lens.
Yeah. And I think for the builders, I'll also say that I know that I don't know a lot about what they did, but I know that they always did it at night. Because as you can imagine, I don't think Cal was the most excited about students climbing without ropes on scaling their buildings like Spider-Man.
So the optometry building was one of these buildings. Is this still something that happens? Like, I'm thinking now there's that new building on the corner of Telegraph and Haste. It's called the Enclave. It was described by the San Francisco Chronicle, I think, as like Fred Flintstone's McMansion on acid or something like that, because it sort of looks like this like Moorish temple, but the first couple floors of it have this like faux rock exterior. Has anyone builded on that one yet that you're aware of, or would that even be possible?
It looks extremely possible, so but I don't know of anyone in particular, but perhaps they should get in touch with me or you and share their stories.
Gotcha. What about you? Have you climbed any buildings in the Bay Area that you can say on the record, or is that a no comment type situation?
Yeah, I've kept myself to rocks.
Gotcha. Okay. So now, this is still a beautiful place to come. As you mentioned earlier, during the pandemic, this was a place that especially was popular because a lot of the climbing gyms were closed. But of course, now that those climbing gyms have reopened, there are plenty of options for people who want to climb, even in, you know, cold weather at night or on a rainy day. When did that start becoming, like, when did climbing gyms start opening? When did that become part of the sport?
Yeah, so climbing gyms started opening in the 90s, and very quickly they changed how people climbed at Indian and Mortar Rocks and climbed in general. I mean, it ushered in an entirely new era of what we see now, which is, you know, little kids who grew up scrambling all over climbing gyms and on climbing teams, and they're crazy strong at 6 years old or whatever. So it's totally fundamentally changed the sport from something that was done by kind of a few wacky, misunderstood individuals into, you know, an Olympic sport and something that's, you know, to me, it often feels like, you know, everyone and their mom has a membership at a climbing gym here nowadays.
That's another question I have. How did this sport get so insanely popular? It feels like downtown Berkeley's economy now is like reliant on rock climbing gyms. I often think about what people from the past would have thought if they could see, you know, the present day. And I'm just trying to imagine like taking someone from like the 19 teens from Berkeley into downtown Berkeley now, and they're like, what happened to all the movie theaters? And it's like, oh, people pay to climb the walls in those buildings now. And I can just see like the look of total, you know, astonishment and disbelief on their faces when that is explained to them. How did climbing get so, like, what, you know, it just seems like, yeah, it's everywhere now.
Yeah, I mean, also Walgreens got turned into a climbing gym in downtown Berkeley, and there's another climbing gym opening up, or I guess that one's in North Berkeley. There's another climbing gym opening up near Solano very soon. So I suspect that we have the most per capita climbing gyms out of any city in the country, but perhaps I'm wrong.
It's like the Starbucksification of climbing gyms. It's like, if you don't like this climbing gym, there's another one kitty corner from here, right?
Yeah, exactly. What was your question?
Just like, how did climbing get so popular? Like, is this, because I feel like, you know, there's been climbing gyms for, like you said, since the 90s, but it's really been maybe, I don't know, the last decade or so that it's just exploded. Is that accurate from a kind of outsider's perspective?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have no idea why it's incredibly popular, to be honest, but I can say that the conversation about what people from the past would have thought about the explosion of climbing, like, I think this is a huge topic of conversation within the climbing community. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, making climbing more accessible to more diverse groups of people by virtue of it being more popular is a huge boon to the sport. You know, I think it has been known for a long time at Indian and Mortar Rocks and everywhere as being like this kind of strong white guy's sport. And now that the people who are climbing have started to look extremely different. And that's an incredible thing. I think the climbing community largely.
It's okay. We've just got some more Berkeley ambient sounds in the background here. The beautiful sound of some acapella singing, but please continue.
Where was I?
Just about how diversity has made it more inclusive.
Yeah, and then I think simultaneously that some people in the climbing community really are concerned about the cost of having a lot more people out climbing who are not, especially climbing outside, who aren't really familiar with the ethic of it or aren't familiar with the safety techniques of it. I think climbing in the gym is really different than climbing outside, and a lot of climbers see themselves as stewards of the land, and when they see people kind of show up to the crag having never climbed, maybe they either get themselves hurt or don't take care of the space, and those concerns, I think, shouldn't be diametrically opposed to one another in any way, but in the conversations of the climbing communities, they mm-hmm. can be kind of pitted against one another in a way that I think is unfortunate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that one thing you talk about in the article is how, you know, previous generations of climbers, I think like sort of like the first generation or two, they would actually nail the pitons, you know, these giant kind of nail-like structures into the rocks here to anchor their ropes. But that is not something that happens anymore, right? So people have a different kind of relationship in terms of trying to have like less of an impact on the rocks now here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, here and everywhere else, there people worked out techniques that were more aligned with the leave no trace ethic. And that's kind of like one branch of climbing, is like both in bouldering and in traditional climbing now without the use of pitons, is like you climb the rock and then it's as if you had never been there, sort of the ideal. Mm-hmm. But then there's a whole other side of rock climbing that isn't visible here, but which involves drilling bolts into the rocks in order to be able to ascend faces that don't have natural cracks and things like this. And it's called sport climbing. It's extremely popular, but can also be controversial, both in the climbing community for people who think you shouldn't be defacing the rock, and for, in some places, when the rocks are sacred to indigenous people who disagree about either climbing there at all, or especially damaging the rock through the drilling of bolts. And here there's really like one or two spots where bolts are drilled into the wall, which is actually over that ankle breaker boulder problem. So if you want to do it on a rope and do it that way, it's a little safer. Yeah.
Sounds good. So I think anytime people are really passionate about something, they're going to have, you know, strong responses to coverage of it. Mm. You just did this huge feature for Berkeley Side. Great article, by the way. I really learned so much from it. How did the climbing community respond to that? Did people like having the spotlight put on them, or was there any negative responses to it as well?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for reading the story, and I'm glad that you liked it. How did the climbing community respond? I think a lot of people have been stoked about it. I put up QR codes that we made to the story in climbing gyms, and I have a couple more here that I might leave around too. And for the most part, I think people, like, one thing that's cool about climbing is that there's a very strong tradition of passing on knowledge about the climbs over time. So people will show up to a rock like the one that we're sitting on, and someone nearby will probably know something about who was the first person to figure out this sequence of moves up the rock, or who was the first person to figure out that you could do it this way instead of that way. You know, if you just put your foot here and your hand there, it makes it that much easier. Like, people are really plugged into those kind of stories and pass them on orally. And I think, like, that's a super beautiful aspect of it. And I think, like, one thing that I was doing in this story was putting onto paper and into text some of those kind of oral narratives. And I think that is, you know, something that I value as a writer, but also recognize is like a kind of can be a fraught thing, both in documenting the climbing history, but also the indigenous history as well, which I did in another story. So, yeah, I think I think for the most part the story has been extremely well received. In terms of, I have had some climbers disagree with the depiction of rock climbing as, I would say, like, not problematic or not inclusive in the way that I described it in the story, or like its history of sometimes not being that, and, you know, people talking about, like, you know, when I was climbing here in the 90s, there were all these women, and
some of my best friends are women. My mom was a woman. It's like, chill, bro.
Yeah, but
you did interview a woman who was climbing here since back in like the 60s or 70s, as I mansplain your own article to you real quickly. And I mean, this was not your perspective. You asked her what her experiences were, and I mean, like, what did she tell you?
Yeah, and I think this points to the challenges of, like, documenting, like, decades and decades worth of history in one place. Like, and I'm sure you encounter this all the time in your own podcast, which is just like different people are going to tell you different stuff about a place, and you're trying to walk the line between just sharing people's stories, but also putting together a cohesive narrative. And, you know, trying not to say something too definitive, but also wanting people to walk away with, like, some sort of takeaway, not just, like, a fragmented collection of memories. And, like, yeah, I think Amy Fillon, who I spoke with, is a really good example. She started climbing here when she was a Cal student and, like, immediately fell in love with climbing. And yeah, she recently had a stroke and nevertheless is still rock climbing at the gym. And so she's like, to me, is a huge inspiration to all of us. But, you know, I asked her a lot of questions about what was it like to be a woman climbing here at the time. And she was like, you know, it was more about what was it like to be a woman climber in the broader world. Because here was where she felt accepted. Here was where the people, you know, thought, you know, as long as you can climb, it doesn't so much matter. And she actually kind of, at the time, she wanted to be around people who knew more than her, who would keep her safe and take care of her. And she really liked that about all the people she met. She kind of gravitated toward kind of the responsible figure, you know, male figures that were around at the time, versus other people who weren't involved in the climbing community would ask her, you know, who's going to marry you with skinny knees, or, you know, point to her biceps and say, why do you need those? And so I think that just speaks to, like, the cultural change that has happened with women in sports more broadly. And, you know, at least Amy's experience was really positive here. I think that's not the case for every woman. Yeah. But
just real quick, those are two of the worst pickup lines I've ever heard in my entire life. All right, just pausing here to mention that you might notice that the singing in the background is getting a little bit louder throughout this conversation. I hope it doesn't bother you. You know, some lady singing at the top of her lungs by herself in the middle of a residential park. It's exactly the kind of colorful ambiance that makes Berkeley so Berkeley. And hey, it's a lot better than the sound of a leaf blower. All right, back to the interview. You said earlier that you spend a lot of time here. You know, you're here all the time climbing, hanging out, reporting. I know that a lot of the people who hang out here are part of this community. People have been coming here maybe for years, maybe for decades. You know, it's like a multi-generational scene. Are there people who come here from other parts of the country? Is this like a little mini Yosemite in the sense that, you know, climbers are coming to the Bay Area from other parts of the country or even the world, and they need to come to Mortar Rock or Indian Rock to see the place that they've read about in some of these, you know, climbing history books? Have you bumped into people like that sort of on a climbing pilgrimage?
I think your question kind of speaks to, like, the heart of why this place became so popular. And, like, in many ways it was born out of necessity, right? Like, part of the reason that climbing culture is so booming in the Bay is that we have such amazing climbing in California, Northern California, within, you know, 4 or 5 hours drive, world class. Like, those are the places that people pilgrimage to. But you know what people need when they pilgrimage is a place to climb as they're heading there. And, you know, this for so many decades, for over a century, has been that. It's been the place that people need, you know, when they need to climb and they're in Berkeley, they'll come here because this is the best, closest, most convenient, highest concentration of climbs. And so that's how this place developed into a sort of mini climbing mecca, not because the climbing was so incredible, which in for what it is great. But it's not Yosemite by any means, but incredible names have passed through here just out of the sheer convenience of the location. And out of that, there's kind of has grown climbing lore and legends and history. And then people come here and they become really invested in immersing in that. So I think this is less of like a visitor's destination in some ways than it is like a regular's destination of like, I live in Berkeley, I live in Oakland, and I know every inch of this spot, as opposed to, you know, a place like, you know, a major destination like Yosemite or somewhere else where you might go and you might check off something on your bucket list and come back, but you'll always have this in your backyard.
Gotcha. Wow. Very cool. Well, you covered so much history in your article, and I encourage people to read the whole thing, and actually both articles, because there's two related pieces about these rocks. But is there anything else we haven't talked about today that you want to cover?
Yeah, on the note of inclusivity and the sport being accepting, one kind of fun piece of like oral record keeping is that so one of the climbs here that's kind of an iconic maybe benchmark or something for climbers who are like pretty serious about the sport is a traverse called Knott's Traverse on Mortar Rock. There's this kind of oral passed on record of who are the first ex women who have been able to ascend that climb. And I found out about that and I asked some of the women that I spoke with and they said, oh yeah, I'm number 8 or I'm number 15. Whoa. Yeah. And all kind of kept in memory by one guy who passed away a couple years ago named Rodney. I think it just like exemplifies the spirit of the place in some ways. There's so much like story and memory that's like passed along that, and like you wouldn't know it from looking at the wall, but if you start to listen and start to listen to the people who come here, you'll start to see that there's these kind of generations of climbers whose stories are like being told by one another and shared over and over again, and it's really lovely.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, this is such a special place. It's been really nice to spend the afternoon with you here, Allie, sitting on these rocks, talking about the history of Indian and Mortar Rocks in Berkeley, climbing destinations known all around the world, but especially beloved by the local climbing community here. Thank you so much for talking to me this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me, Liam. Thanks for your interest.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of East Bay Yesterday. If you enjoy this show and want to know more about local history or hear about upcoming events, please sign up for my newsletter. It's free, it's only about once a month, and now that social media has proven to be incredibly fickle and unreliable, this email newsletter is your best bet for keeping up with things. Like, for example, on April 25th, I'll be moderating a very special event at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland. For this one, I'll be interviewing several of my favorite Oakland side reporters about their incredible coverage of local history issues. And I know that sounds a little vague, but don't worry. I can assure you that it will be a lively and very informative discussion. So stay tuned for more details. I'll be sharing all the info in my newsletter, or as always, via the East Bay Yesterday Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Links for all those are at my website, eastbayyesterday.com. And of course, we'll also be announcing that on the Oakland side website as well. Okay. Extra big shout out to those of you supporting East Bay Yesterday on Patreon or through my Substack. This show relies on small donations to survive. So if you can chip in, anything helps. And you can find the link to that Patreon page, of course, at my website as well. Also, big thanks to everyone at Berkeley Side who helped make Allie's article possible, specifically Zach Farber, Jimena Hitera, and of course, Allie herself. And you know what? Big ups to the founders of Berkeley Side as well. Lance Noble, Tracy Taylor, Francis Dinkenspiel. You have all created such a necessary local institution. Thank you. All right. Music for this episode came from Justin Lee. That's about it. I've been your host, Liam O'Donohue. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you want to hear more East Bay Yesterday.